Hello, and welcome to another episode of GDPR Now, a podcast dedicated to all things related to data security and data privacy, brought to you by Data Protection for Business. Your host today is me, Karen Heaton, owner of Data Protection for Business. I'm recording from my home office in Southwest London. This episode's part of our series of podcasts addressing security and privacy concerns coming from the coronavirus pandemic and the shift in working practices for millions of businesses across the UK and the world. Now, in this episode, we're going to talk about the UK Track and Trace app and explore whether track and trace apps are prevented from being successful due to some privacy and practicality issues. So I'm delighted to have joining me today, across the airwaves from Cheshire, a software professional with over 30 years experience in software projects, many in different industries, including retail, banking, defence and automotive, and in the last 10 years or so, the NHS. Our guest, David, has a particular interest in NHS IT because he founded his own software company and he works in that sector. So he's in a unique position to give us the benefit of his experience. The government's Track and Trace app is going to be the subject of our conversation today. And David writes regularly about track and trace apps in general in Lockdown Skeptics website, which is run by Toby Young. So, David, welcome to GDPR Now. We're delighted to have you here.
Thanks, Karen. Nice to be on the podcast. And thanks for the kind intro. As you say, I've been involved in software for a long time now. Well, all my professional career. I've had quite a bit of exposure to government-run software projects. So when the coronavirus thing came around, and of course the inevitable there's an app for that storyline came up, it really caught my attention because I thought, okay, here we go. It's going to be a super high-profile government software project, and so I've been paying very close attention to it. As it kind of went from being a subplot in the whole COVID drama to really coming into the limelight,
it is
back in March and April.
It's taken a lead role, really, hasn't it? Let's face it. And unfortunately, the government doesn't have necessarily the best track record of large IT programs, which actually in themselves are hugely problematic, regardless of which organization is trying to do them. I mean, I've got a background in software as well, so I think we both realize how difficult and complicated large technology programs are.
Indeed, yes. And the government has done attempted many of them over the years, and as they are cancelled or fail, it says it'll learn the lessons, but unfortunately it seldom seems to. And the Track and Trace app is the latest example of that. People like me writing and blogging, saying, pointing out lessons that had been learned in previous projects and really hoping the government was going to listen to us about them. And as we see, it hasn't really done that. But we can get to the detail of that shortly.
Yeah. So how did we get here then? It's the end of September. We've been talking about track and trace apps all year. In fact, I did a podcast earlier in the year with Sainty Law from Sydney, and we talked about the Australian track and trace app back in May. So where are we now?
That's right. Australia were quite quick out of the traps, actually, with their track and trace app. And in fact, it was based on Singapore's app, who were, I think, pretty much the first country to release an app, certainly based on Bluetooth technology. Mm-hmm. And that was back in March. But the conversation really got going in the UK in April. There was a lot of hope pinned on this approach. The Times ran an article on the 1st of April quoting Oxford University, saying that mobile contact tracing apps would, quote, massively reduce transmission. And they said, the maths is clear that, the more people that use contact tracing apps, the better the chance we have of getting ahead of this epidemic and eventually stopping it in its tracks. So, there's a lot of faith, all the way down to, what sounded like a mathematical proof, that these apps would be effective. And so a huge enthusiasm for it. But then, of course, very quickly the privacy question comes up. And in fact, the EU were the first people, you know, almost first people to raise this. And they made a statement in April saying that, you know, EU member states must not deploy apps which store data centrally. So I mean, they said that on April 17th. And security researchers around the world, you know, picked up on this as well. There was an open letter from 300 security and privacy researchers from 27 countries, not just the EU, that raised concerns about things like, you know, apps being written for this purpose but then being repurposed, you know, for surveillance purposes later on. You know, the problems of you know, that you may need to kind of record location data, so you're essentially tracking citizens, and then also things like mission creep. You know, you write it for one purpose and then it starts getting used for another purpose. So there was, you know, a lot of expert advice out there saying, you know, you've got to be careful with this kind of thing. And also early on, so Apple and Google kind of stepped forward and said that they were going to be, you know, helping out here and taking a very privacy protecting approach. And
is that the version that they used in Singapore?
Yeah. So this kind of started coming to life through April and May. It actually started out with some academic researchers in Switzerland who wrote a paper called the Decentralized Privacy Preserving Proximity Tracing Project, the DP3T project, where they basically looked at all the possible design options for these apps and kind of methodically went through and analyzed the security and privacy implications of all the design options. And actually they showed that, you know, all the options have flaws. But the decentralized approach, what became known as decentralized approach, was the one that Google and Apple went for, and they said they were heavily inspired by that DP3 work. And then, you know, kind of other countries decided to go along with that. So, you know, in April, Switzerland, Austria, Estonia, Finland, Germany, they all said they were going to use this kind of decentralized design as highlighted by the DP3T project.
But I guess at that point, the NHSX program was already up and running.
Yeah, they were already talking about it. Yeah. And they were putting great store in it. And so it was being discussed. It was discussed in Parliament. So at the end of April, the NHSX team were asked to talk to the Parliament's Human Rights Committee. And this is where it really started getting interesting, because it looked very much like they were going to reject the decentralized approach. So they said, and I've got a little quote here, they said the purpose for choosing a centralized database model over the more data secure and private decentralized model is that it allows for greater data analysis. And they were saying that it has public health advantages. You know, it allows health authorities to analyze how the virus is spreading. It allows them to help prevent spread of the virus. You know, it allows hospitals to prepare for surges. And then slightly ominously, they said it also allows for improvements of efficiency of the app in future versions. So they're kind of almost signaling that mission creep is designed in, you know, from the start, which...
It's perhaps worth just considering that position. No, clearly mission creep is an issue.
Yes.
Now, the idea of having a richer set of data, especially at the beginning of an epidemic, where little is known about the virus itself, how it spreads, et cetera, isn't entirely Machiavellian in its own right, really, is it? Because the government has a responsibility to look after public health.
Yes.
And actually, here we are at the end of September. We're now having further lockdown restrictions. We've now got businesses who are losing confidence because they don't know when they're going to be able to open freely. You know, there is an argument for a richer data set, centrally managed potentially, that could better inform our policy making decisions. The problem to that becomes what you've just described, which is the potential for scope creep.
Yes.
And constant tracking of individuals.
Indeed. So yes, you can imagine in, you know, Matt Hancock's mind's eye, there's, you know, he's got his map of the UK with, you know, coloured blobs of, you know, hotspots of the virus on it. And he, you know, that's, you can kind of see he's kind of hoping that's what the app's going to give him. And that, you know, that would be great data to feed into all sorts of government programs. You know, it's the kind of dashboard you'd expect a kind of company CEO to have. The fly in the ointment here is that you're talking about, you know, individual private citizens. You're not talking about employees of a company who operate under an employment contract, you know. So, yes, you can imagine, you know, company field engineers out there with the company software collecting all sorts of data about a product or, you know, or a service, and that's all fed back to, you know, to operations and head office in the company. And, you know, of course, lots and lots of companies, you know, have that kind of system. It's different in the public sector. It's different. You know, we don't all work for the government. We have rights and liberties, and you know, and from a citizen's point of view, you know, you may need to be protected from government overreach, and you know, and from, you know, from private contractors and so on who operate from the government. You know, you have some legal protection. So it's a much trickier area to operate in, even though your kind of cause might be a noble one, you know, in protecting everyone's safety. You have to tread very carefully. And, you know, this is one of the lessons that the government, you know, seems to struggle to learn from previous, you know, previous healthcare projects. So, yes, I think the motivation was, you know, was perfectly reasonable, but you do have to tread ever so carefully in this area. Because you're going to find yourself illegal, basically, or, you know, contravening the law.
And they did in the beginning, didn't they, for the initial release of the NHSX app, they released a data protection impact assessment, which
they eventually got around to doing one. Yes, I mean, they actually operated for a while without one, and then got called out as operating unlawfully. Yes, they did eventually get around to doing one, but it really wasn't front of mind. I mean, I think the political leaders who were driving this, you know, had great ambitions for it, and in some way saw it as a bit of a shortcut. And what you could see was that the techies who were supporting them were kind of had a different idea in mind. And it was quite interesting that, you know, in early May, the design was published for the NHSX app.
They published the code as well, didn't they?
Indeed. And when you looked at the design was almost deliberately stuffed with kind of, you know, cryptographic jargon, and, you know, talked of, you know, the parameters to be used in elliptic curve, you know, cryptographic ciphers, and, you know, things operating Galois counter mode and all this kind of stuff. It was really meant to kind of lay on the kind of the crypto tech pretty heavily to kind of, you know, squash any kind of idea that it might not be a secure app. But, you know, buried in the detail of all that, you realize that, in fact, you know, it couldn't actually collect that much data about you. And when you looked at the unencrypted payload, it really just had like a signal strength and a time of day and a random unidentified identifier. It had almost, you know, no data in it whatsoever. And you kind of thought, hang on a minute, I'm not sure that the political face of this is really connected to what the techies are proposing.
Right. Okay. Because I did have a look at the design, and I have to say I found it quite tricky to understand. I'm not a developer.
But... Well, it was a real kind of hardcore cryptographic, you know, almost academic paper from the National Center for Cybersecurity. And I mean, those guys really know their stuff.
Yeah.
Which is great. But one thing that struck you was that it was a rather academic paper, and it didn't really contemplate the practicalities, you know, the kind of human factors side of things. You know, so I mean, it's all well and good if your data is being encrypted like that and it's all been operated according to the, you know, to the theory, but we all know that in practice, theory and practice differ. Yeah. And it was an interesting example of this that emerged later in the summer. So in July, the Times ran an article saying that track and trace operatives, if you like, had been caught sharing case data on Facebook. You know, which is a horror story, really, because it's highly sensitive personal medical data. It was kind of floating around on Facebook pages. And of course, it just hadn't even gone into the system. So, yeah, there was great cryptographic security in the app. But, you know, the people part of the wider system weren't even using the app for that bit. They, you know, they just posted private data on Facebook.
Yeah, because the app's only part of the overall solution, isn't it? You've got all the operations that go on around it.
That's right, and this was something which really the mainstream medium narrative didn't really pick up on, that, you know, an app is just seen widely as just something that's on your phone and that's the end of it. But of course, there's all the kind of back-end systems and everything that might be integrated with back there. And, you know, there was no attention paid to that side of things. So and actually to this day, you can go and have a look at the code on GitHub, actually. It's all open source. You can go and have a look at the Android and the Swift code for Apple devices. But the server-side stuff is not on there. So, you know, you kind of wonder what's going on in the background.
Yeah. So we started off going down the centralized route. There was quite a lot of hue and cry. Then there was a bit of a change of heart.
There was. And actually, the change of heart's interesting because the design was published in some ways to kind of mollify the press. And then very shortly afterwards, there was a trial announced in Isle of Wight. And the story was that it was going to prove that the technology worked, because everyone was afraid that the technology, there would just be kind of technology problems, as have been in so many government projects. There were technology issues, things operating on old devices, people having difficulty with network connections, people not understanding how to turn Bluetooth on their device, you know, those kind of things.
Fairly normal thing.
Pretty straightforward stuff that you always find in early user trials, and those are the kind of things, insofar as it made it into the press, those are the things that made the headlines. But what wasn't said so much was that the app just wasn't detecting many exposure events. Mm-hmm. And we suspected this was going to be a problem because that's what had happened in Australia, for example. So in Australia, they'd found almost no exposure alerts being generated by their software. And actually similar in Singapore. So we knew this was going to be an issue. And the reason that's an issue is because the app is only legal under data protection laws if it's effective. So it has to be effective enough to justify the personal data that it's handling. And if the efficacy isn't there, then it doesn't support the privacy intrusion. And so if you don't get enough detections, you can't use the app. So there's a kind of chicken and egg problem in that.
Yeah.
In order to get the app out there, it has to be effective, but it doesn't seem to be effective enough, so we can't actually give it to people because it won't then be legal or lawful. And this was actually pointed out by Harriet Harman's Joint Parliamentary Human Rights Committee, and that was pointed out in April that, you know, they doubted whether it would be effective enough to clear the bar set mm-hmm. by the data protection legislation. And, you know, it's never really been admitted by the government, but I suspect that that's actually what happened in Isle of Wight, was that there were so few exposure notifications that it just couldn't clear the bar legally. And so really, it was, you know, it was a write-off just from a kind of legal standpoint.
But just, so if there weren't many exposure notifications, is that because it wasn't effective, or that there just weren't that many cases out there?
Well, who knows? I mean, from a legal point of view, it doesn't really matter. You know, if you're not getting notifications, that's it. It's not effective enough. But you're right. I mean, it may be because there weren't enough, you know, the prevalence of the actual virus may not have been sufficient to, you know, to trigger the software, even if it was all working perfectly. But we also know there are just practical issues with, you know, the way that exposures are detected.
Yeah, and yeah, let's talk about some of the practical issues. Because I think some of these other countries may have experienced similar issues. I know in Australia they had a number of practical issues with their app.
Yeah, I mean, Singapore's a good case in point. So, you know, they had a lot of people download the app there, a kind of good proportion of the population. But there was a significant part of the population that didn't get the app, and that was very low-paid migrant workers. Mm-hmm. You know, who lived in dormitory accommodation and quite simply can't afford to have a fancy new iPhone or a top of the range, Android phone, which was needed for their software.
Yeah.
So Singapore, found, I think the number was something like 44,000, coronavirus infections, none of which were picked up by their software because it was all in the migrant worker community, and it was spreading quickly through the dormitories, but nobody had the software because nobody had the phones. So you got this problem that you need people to have mobile devices. And back in the UK, we were getting to know that it was something.
They need to have mobile devices, but the right ones.
The right ones, yeah, exactly. And as we got to know more about the who was suffering from COVID-19, it tends to be affecting the elderly and the vulnerable more, and that's the community with least likely to have to have up to date mobile devices or even be using them.
Well, and also for communities who live in close contact with each other, many people in houses, and dormitories, for example, for certain communities, if they're low skilled or low waged earners, they can't afford their own two bedroom flat or three bedroom.
Yeah, exactly. So there were kind of population considerations. There were also just straightforward tech considerations. On a kind of, naive level, the way the thing works is, it doesn't actually track your location using GPS tracking. That would be too expensive on your battery. So it actually uses Bluetooth Low Energy, which is designed to be on all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And so your phone broadcasts just a random number, which is unique to your phone. Other phones listen out for that on Bluetooth in the same way that you might pick up another, you might pick up a printer or another phone nearby.
Yeah.
The phone looks at the signal strength and so tries to make an estimate based on the strength of the signal as to how far away the phone is. So in theory, O-level physics, inverse square law kicks in, you should be able to kind of work out from the signal strength how far away the transmitter is. Unfortunately, in practice, that it's not as simple as that, and your environment really affects the transmission of the Bluetooth signal,
the quality of it,
and the quality of it. Yes. So, and of course, the phone is not aware of its environment, so the phone doesn't know that it's in your bag, or that it's inside, the metal cased carriage of a train or a bus, it's on the other side of a breeze block wall. And of course, all of that location and environment information is important to really accurately say, whether you are even in contact with somebody. If you're on the other side of a wall, then you're not in danger of being exposed to a virus, even though you might just be 6 inches away from them.
Yeah, exactly. A different house.
Absolutely. And there was some research done by some researchers in the University of Dublin and showing, just how crazy some of the results were from real life scenarios. So they took phones out into supermarkets or on in buses and train carriages. They found that, on a train carriage, for example, your phone could think that you're actually nearer to the people at the other end of the carriage than you are to people sat next to you, simply because of the way the Bluetooth signal is funneled by the coachwork of the carriage. So you've got those kind of things. Now they could be giving you, false positives, but they could also be giving you false negatives as well. And of course you also have to decide, well, just being close to somebody isn't enough. You have to be close to them for a, extended period of time. So you have to pick your time period. So, they went for 15 minutes. So you have to be, basically have a certain signal strength from the transmitter for 15 minutes, at which point the software will remember the ID that's been transmitted. And then from time to time, it'll go back up to the cloud and just say, right, give me all the IDs that have declared themselves to be positive, brings those IDs down, checks it against the list of ones that it's remembered. And if there's a match, it says, okay, I don't know who it was or when it was, but you were exposed, you were near somebody who's declared themselves to be positive. And that's how the Apple Google approach works. But it's how the NHS original design was proposed to work as well. So in fact, deep down, they're both the same.
Okay. It's although the storage of the data must be different because we've gone from decentralized.
Well, in fact, so this is again one of the kind of slightly false narratives in the media is that the the government went for a centralized approach, and that's really what the politicians were trying to justify, and the politicians thought they were going to get all this location data, and they'd have a really rich data set to help them, you know, fight the good fight. When you actually look at the design, there's very little data in there that's stored centrally. What is done centrally with the NHS approach is the exposure calculation. So that, you know, have I been exposed? In the Apple and Google approach, that's done by the operating system on the phone, whereas the NHS approach, that was done centrally on a central server. So it was actually the computation that was done centrally rather than the data. So at the end of all this, you know, the approach wasn't really suffering from a centralized data problem, you know, after all that.
Gone on. But anyway, yeah, let's keep going. So we've talked about the practicalities of the phones, the age of the phone,
yes,
the environment the phone finds itself in. You know,
yeah, absolutely. I mean, are you facing the person that you're, you know, allegedly exposed to, or you're actually sitting with your back to them? That kind of thing. The phone doesn't really know. When you look at it in some detail, it's a really crude approach. And you know, having your phone be sufficiently close to someone else's phone for 15 minutes or more. So perhaps it's not so surprising that so few notifications were raised. I mean, there's some sociological issues as well in that you have to, I mean, the phone doesn't know whether you're positive or not, so you have to tell the phone.
Yeah.
So originally the NHS design relied on the user notifying the phone, but that then opens you to kind of malicious actors.
Yeah.
So, you know, you can imagine if I'm grumpy and I've fallen out with my employer, a good way to, you know, prank them would be to, you know, hawk my phone around the office for a few days, and then go back home and hit the big red button. And then that would, you know, cause everyone to have to isolate.
Yeah.
You know, or not even malicious actors, you know, just if you think about somebody who's very active in a hospital, like a hospital porter, who's, you know, going around all the wards and all, you know, behind the scenes and, you know, all over the hospital, if they test positive, I mean, in some ways you kind of want to alert everybody that somebody who's been all over a hospital is positive, but, you know, you're going to have a message going out to, you know, almost every employee in a hospital to say you can't come in. You'd shut down a hospital.
Which is just not happening. That's just not practical.
Yeah. Yeah. And actually, the NHS design originally contemplated this problem and said, look, we're going to have an army of clinicians analysing the data centrally and stopping these cascades, as they call them. But, you know, it's a huge organisational effort to do that.
Yeah.
I mean, interestingly, what you're seeing coming out in various pieces in the media now is that the track and trace employees are saying that the organisation of that effort is somewhat lacking, you know, so having to train and operate an army of thousands of people, you know, looking at this data is a challenge in itself. And you know, the app kind of outsources that problem to this huge army of track and trace specialists, but they, you know, that you've still got the problem, right?
Yeah, exactly. Because a friend of mine, she was a retired midwife, and she was asked to come back and man the phones for the track and trace. And, you know, even all of that required, you know, a bit of training, access to the system, and you're trying to onboard thousands of people at one time. You know, it's no small project or program in and of itself.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So
from, you know, the whole operational element to this, to rapidly ramp up people, operational processes and technology into a one good functioning operation is not.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely.
I certainly do have some sympathies with trying to ramp up quickly. We should have more of the army, though, I think.
Yeah. I mean, there's yet another layer on top of that. And that's, again, the kind of political claims that this was going to be a world-class track and trace system, which, you know, invites you to go and look at other track and trace systems around the world. And when you do that, you realize they have access to a lot more data than than really would be acceptable in the UK. So, you know, they get access to records from the telco companies, you know, to kind of, you know, double check your location, access to your, in some cases, your financial records, you know, to look at, you know, where were you spending money, you know, where were you using your, you know, where were you using your kind of debit card and credit cards and things like that. There's even an app which gets access to your, which requires you to have access to the photos on your phone so they can have a look and see what you're doing.
This is a great point because this question has just been fermenting in my mind, which kind of brings us on to the whole, is privacy a barrier to success for these apps? You know, as you've just talked about, the more data the app has, the more useful computations and information it can provide. Now, in Taiwan, I think it was Taiwan, they were using data travel information data sets. Mm-hmm. To build on the information they were already getting from the app itself. But in the experience that you've had and the research you've done in this, can you think of any Western European country subjected to GDPR who has been doing that in terms of combining multiple data sets to get the app information?
Well, no. I mean, as far as we know, nobody's doing it. And in fact, some countries have been, you know, quite good in putting their hand up and saying we may have gone too far here. So, in fact, Norway, for example, put a pause on use of its app in the middle of June, and it just said, you know, this is we're unsure as to whether we're able to do this legally under our data protection laws. And they actually subsequently deleted all of the user data because of, you know, the kind of concerns over well, both privacy and security. So Norway actually, you know, kind of stepped back from that. Actually, Denmark was similar. It temporarily paused its app in June and deleted data as well. As you've mentioned, Australia came under, you know, really heavy fire. For, you know, not taking privacy and security seriously enough. I think, you know, it's governments do pay attention to this ultimately. And it's, you know, when you see what's going on in other countries, you can see, you know, where it could end up if they don't, which is, you know, quite scary. You know, kind of mandating use of apps, for example. So I think, you know, I think it was actually the Vietnamese app where, you know, it's mandatory for all citizens and the app requires access to your photos. I mean, just think about that for a moment.
And I totally agree and understand, but I think where it feels like we're getting to with the discussion around apps being a really great solution to this, to the spread of any virus. You know, today it's coronavirus. You know, in previous years for other countries in Asia, you know, they've had SARS and they've had MERS. Yeah. They've had, you know, horrible viruses as well that kill a lot more people.
Yeah.
And at some point, society has to have a mechanism to discuss and work out what they're willing to give up in order to save the health of large sections of the population. Now, at the moment, from what I understand, it doesn't feel to me like, you know,
yes, there needs to be a grown-up discussion about this. And, you know, the regulators are, you know, the people who could be kind of shepherding that conversation along. Unfortunately, the time to have that discussion isn't in the heat of a, you know, of fighting a
pandemic.
And so the legislation has been made in haste, and you don't get the best legislation out of it. But yes, I think it's a, you know, it's a discussion which is it's going to take a long while to work out how to do this, and it's highly politicized and therefore rather difficult. But we need to be realistic and not be looking for kind of silver bullets. So I think that's got to be part of the discussion. And not, you know, so failures not just put down to kind of government incompetence or, you know, the performance of one or other politician. You know, we have to kind of admit what the tech can or cannot do, what is practical at these kind of scales, you know, and weigh the balances of privacy versus safety. And you know, be honest about, you know, other risks. I mean, something that struck me was that we, you know, intensively discuss this app, but this is just one of about 80 apps on my phone. You know, I think the average number of apps on anybody's phone is around about 80, and they're chock full of personal data, you know.
Yeah. And there's no, I will say, far fewer checks and balances than there is in the stuff that the government's got to put out. Because
that's right.
I have a teenage daughter, and I tell you, they don't look at the T's and C's when they sign up to an app.
No, absolutely.
They use Instagram, they turn on the microphone to record a message to their friend, and they mention a new pair of trainers, and the next thing they know, those trainers are being advertised in their feed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
They have no idea what they're doing, which is a whole other topic.
Yeah. Well, this is it. I mean, this is why, I mean, as we said at the beginning, it's one thing for a kind of commercial organization to put an app out there and, you know, and you realize all of a sudden your data has been used to advertise to you. But when it's citizens and the government, you do have to take on board, you know, that government can legislate, it can fine you, you know, it has, you know, the police are part of this. You know, when you have, and we've seen this in other areas, right, with, you know, people, you know, tweeting things and then, you know, the police turning up and saying that they're, you know, they're coming around to check their thinking about a tweet that they've just put out. You know, that's when it starts getting scary. Yeah. And that's why it's a balancing act between, you know, safety and privacy, really. And it's far from clear to me where that line lies at the moment.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, if this virus was killing 50% of everybody who got it, we'd be having a very different conversation.
Yes, indeed.
But we're not at that point. So really, the practical challenges are just as relevant as the privacy challenges to having an app-based solution that is going to be really efficient and really help with solving the problem. And then we've got the aspect of, okay, so, you know, do we want to give our data over to Google and Apple and other big commercial companies, or do we trust the government with our data? So which actors are you going to put your faith in? I know for a fact that Google and Apple certainly don't pay unemployment benefits when people lose their jobs. They don't have any responsibility to support the citizens' welfare in this country, for example. But that doesn't mean to say that everything, that the government should be given a free hand necessarily in collecting everything is that they want to know about us. So they're really interesting conversations about privacy and who you're giving your information to, that I think for a majority of the population, these conversations are a little bit overdue.
Very much so. I mean, I would expect there's a lot more people thinking about privacy and who can really see their data, since coronavirus, came into all our lives than had previously done so. It was almost certainly a rather niche, obscure, subject of data protection that the general public wasn't really, you know, thinking was ever relevant to them, really, other than ticking a box when they sign up to something and having to clear the cookie banner every time they go to a website. That's probably the limit of it, if they thought about it at all. Yeah. But I think, you know, now it's interesting where you can see both the utility of it, you know, in fighting a health problem, and also the risks in that, you know, the government is sorely tempted to bring in, you know, really stringent draconian legislation, you know, so, you know, ruinous £10,000 fines being given out without any, you know, recourse, you know, to an appeal. Neighbors being encouraged to kind of report on each other, you know, things which would have been unthinkable a year ago and now are, you know, very much, out there for our consideration. And, you know, you can see how they're supported by the data in the app that's in your pocket. I mean, I know, you know, I've got relatives who, you know, have been asking me, well, should I get this app? And I've said, well, it's a decision you're going to have to make for yourself, but you might want to just think about what would you do if you were, you know, asked to isolate, you know, and would you isolate if just because the app told you to? And, you know, do you, how comfortable do you feel about going out? I mean, you know, back when we were only allowed out for an hour a day, you know, and there were people who were definitely, you know, going out for more than an hour a day or more than once a day, and were feeling like, maybe that app in my pocket is, you know, recording that. And, you know, what are the consequences going to be? So, you know, they're all very real now, these issues.
They are. And if you've got location data turned on, which I tend not to, you're being tracked constantly anyway.
Yes.
But not by the government, by yes. other people.
But it's not Google who are going to turn up and hit you with a fine. So, again, it's that kind of, you know.
It's hard as individuals. We watched a film last night, and I'm going to put it on the show notes, actually, called The Social Dilemma on Netflix. And I recommend everybody to watch it, especially if you've got children. And, you know, we need to start thinking about, well, it's almost, I'm not saying it's too late, but, you know, what we give away. And it's a huge amount. And, you know, up till now, you, maybe no bad actors have been using that information, but that's to say that will be the same into the future. So
yes.
It's an amazing topic. It's very, very current, and things like the pandemic really have brought it to the fore, I think. So maybe a little bit of good coming out of what has been a rather dreadful 2020.
Yes, I mean, hopefully, if when all this has calmed down, which hopefully will be sooner rather than later, I really hope that the, you know, the regulators will use this opportunity to have, you know, the debate that's so long overdue, and we'll be all so much more informed about it. And I think we'll be able to have a more grown up and realistic debate about it, rather than it just being a, you know, a subject that's discussed within the industry with
privacy professionals.
With privacy professionals, yes, absolutely.
So I guess to summarise, have we answered the question? Are, you know, track and trace apps, are privacy and practical issues a barrier to success? Well, I think sadly they are in some instances.
Yes, I think they are.
Practicalities are practicalities.
Absolutely, and I think there's enough data there to support that that hypothesis, because. There's a danger that we just say that, you know, oh, well, it's just the UK government isn't any good at running a software project. And there's a certain amount of truth in that, but it's missing the point.
Yeah.
And the reason I say the data's there is because when we look at other countries, they've all had similar problems. You know, in some of my kind of reading around of this, I've looked at other countries, and, you know, if you don't mind, I'll probably just have a quick whiz around and just kind of let people know kind of what's gone wrong. So, I mean, I think you can probably bucket them in a few different ways. So I think just in terms of being intrusive, you know, apps. So, you know, Algeria's app, I mean, that actually caused an investigation by Amnesty International. You know, Kuwait had a similar problem. They also ended up with Amnesty International reporting that they had the most invasive app in the world.
Wow.
You know, places like Indonesia and Ghana, they actually do collect your location data off GPS. Iran's AC19 app, actually Google withdrew it from the App Store because it was collecting so much data. We also already mentioned Vietnam. They thought it was a good idea to access your photos. So I mean that got them into trouble. You know, that's the kind of intrusive kind of dimension. I mean, there's just problems with reliability. Iceland tried the Bluetooth route, but they gave up on that. So those practicalities we talked about earlier, that actually stopped Iceland from using the Bluetooth route. So it uses your location data. Japan had similar problems as well. It's had all sorts of issues with its app, and it suspended its app at least twice. You know, Denmark and Norway, as we've already said, they actually, you know, stopped using the app and deleted the data that had been collected.
And that was from a privacy perspective, wasn't it?
Yeah. And then there's the problem of like uptake. So how do you convince people to start to use it? And that's why we get all this political hoopla around the launch, because you need as many people as possible to download it. And, you know, this is a problem that every company that's ever written an app, you know, wants to know, how do I get people to download my app? Well, obviously a government's got a big marketing budget, and they can get it in, you know, into all the papers. The most recent release of the app, which was just last week, the government bought front page cover advertising on every single daily newspaper. I mean, you think of the budget for that.
It's huge.
Other countries have gone further. So India mandated it. So it's law. You've got to use the app there. UAE, they have a kind of decentralized model, but there are fines for refusing to install and register the app once you've installed it.
Wow.
Yeah. And then countries that we might identify with more culturally, Germany, Ireland, France, Australia, I think those governments must be wondering, was it worth it? France had 8 million downloads in the first month, but got 14 alerts from it.
Whoa.
Ireland had only 91 alerts from its app. Germany was held out as a big success. It actually came up in Prime Minister's Questions Time with Keir Starmer, kind of poking some fun at Boris Johnson that Germany had its app with 16 million downloads, which he's right about. But what he didn't mention was that it had only found 660 cases.
Right. Okay.
Yeah.
There's really is a correlation between, the coverage that is needed across the population and its ability to pick up the notifications and the cases.
Yes.
I've heard the numbers about 60%, but I don't
That's
know.
Right.
Its hat on, I would still say that's a bit low.
The 60% figure comes from an Oxford University paper where they did some modelling and they thought that 60% would be, the watermark we have to pass to get exposure. But actually, they claimed in that paper that any level of uptake would have an impact, and I think actually the data is showing that isn't the case. Low levels of uptake just aren't having the impact, as we're seeing from the low levels of notifications. So it looks like you need, if it is going to work at all, you need to have really high coverage.
Yeah. Because as you said, the practicalities, the communities that don't download it, because they don't have the right phones, they can't afford to have the phones that they need, And if they are communities where there's a bigger prevalence of it, then it's just not going to work.
Exactly.
Right areas to make it effective.
Yes, indeed. And I mean, the government's just run into this with the very latest release. It doesn't work on iPhone 6, and that's because iPhone 6 does not have the Apple exposure notification API in it. So, Matt Hancock was on BBC Breakfast, defending this and saying, well, it's just a small percentage of users that have iPhone 6 or older, but the problem is that a small percentage of a large number is still a large number, is a large number. So, it's less than 3% of people who are in that position, less than 3% of iPhone owners. But when you multiply it out, that's 750,000 people. So that's quite, so that those people aren't, if you believe there are any benefits from the app, that those people are not going to benefit from them.
I agree. Well, it's a topic that I have to say I could talk about all day, but I think we're going to have to finish off there. We've covered the practicality issues around apps for lots of different countries. We've covered the privacy issues and how some countries are far more intrusive and mandate downloading the app and increase and will levy fines if you don't download it. And we've got sort of answered our question around, are privacy and practical issues a barrier to success? Well, we think they are. So I don't know, David, do you have any final words for our listeners before we close off the show? Anything you'd like them to think about as we close?
Well, I'd encourage them all to follow the story. I mean, it may just be me, but I find it a really fascinating case study in kind of this intersection of technology and privacy, and kind of public policy. I think it's a really fascinating area, and I think given your audience, they should take the opportunity when the time is right to really take part in this debate, which I think we keep coming back to saying, we have to have this grown-up debate and hopefully influence the regulators in the right direction to start really shaping up the legislation so that we get some of the benefits while still protecting ourselves from all of the problems that we've talked about. Yeah. So I really encourage everybody to, don't just sit back and hope it'll all work itself out. Do get involved in the debate, talk to your, MP, get online, use your expertise and understanding of the area to really influence things.
Oh, I completely concur with that. I would also encourage everybody to get involved. How we do that yet? We're not quite sure, but I think if enough of us ask the question, we'll get there. So sadly, that does bring us to the end of this episode of GDPR Now. If our listeners have any questions, please do get in touch and email me. I can pass them on to David for you. If there's any other topics you'd like addressed and discussed on the show, please get in touch. And so finally, to our listeners, thanks for listening. But importantly to David, thank you so much for your time. Really appreciate it. It's been a fascinating conversation. And I look forward to speaking to you again soon. So that's it from me, Karen Heaton. I hope you will join us again in the future. Take care. Stay safe. Thank you.